This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, this fine June 23rd, 2014. We're here to talk about your retirement system. Are you in the right one? Anyway, we have Bob Bronstein, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, federal benefits expert, Social Security expert, and you're going to lead us in this. And there's something called, it sounds rough, FERCA?
Yeah, FERCA. It's like I always tell people, if you've been FERCA'd, that means you're on the wrong retirement plan. Kind of interesting. You almost really need to go back to the grassroots of everything, Bob. By the way, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to be up here from sunny Florida, where it's actually cooler than it is in Washington. When I started as a federal employee, which was back in the 70s, there was really only one retirement system. So things were kind of simple. As a matter of fact, I was a retirement counselor. Things changed dramatically when FERS came along. I mean, there were a number of things that led up to FERS. CSRS wasn't contributing to Social Security and still doesn't. Social Security needed additional money. They always do. And in 1983, there was an amendment act that was passed that said feds are going to now start paying Social Security. So after 3 years of an interim program, FERS was launched. CSRS was also a very generous program, which wound up with somewhat of an unfunded liability. There wasn't enough coming out of the contributions from employees and government to ultimately fund what was going to be necessary for retirees for the rest of their lives. It was covering static costs, but it didn't include things like pay raises and cost of living adjustments for retirees.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
You mentioned contributions. Some people might be listening, probably more so FERS than CSRS, but nobody writes a check for this. Correct me if I'm wrong, this is withheld from their pay. And depending on whether you're CSRS, CSRS, or FERS, the percentage is drastically different, but for a reason.
That's correct. CSRS, for generally, you got to be general because there are always exceptions to the rule. Employees generally pay 7% of gross pay every 2 weeks, and that's matched by the government. Now, there are some exceptions in occupational categories, or if you're on the Hill, there's a different formula and so on and so forth.
This is not like a 401k or TSP. No. They get no deduction for this. When they take it out. I mean, they pay tax on that money.
Oh, absolutely correct.
Okay.
And it sets up this defined benefit, which is another one of these terms, which means an annuity that they'll get for the rest of their lives with cost of living allowances and not having to worry or be concerned too much about market fluctuations like you would have to be if you're managing a 401k plan or a TSP. So it's a bit different there. Now, the problem that the reason that there were so many FERCA problems is that the placement and the correct retirement plan after FERS became problematic. A lot of people, let me just summarize why you should be where you should be. Basically, you should be in CSRS if you were hired prior to that Social Security Amendment Act. In other words, if you were hired prior to January 1, 1984, CSRS, and have had no subsequent breaks in service of a year or more, and didn't elect to be in FERS, this is really amazing, during two open enrollment opportunities, one of which was when FERS started in 1987, and another one in 1998. Now, this unique sort of successor plan to CSRS, which is CSRS and Social Security, known as offset, occurred as if you were hired after, or I should say rehired, after January 1st, 1984. In other words, you've been gone for more than a year, but you came back. So you couldn't escape Social Security, but you had 5 years of creditable civilian service prior to the FERS launch date, which was January 1st, 1987, all of which could have been CSRS. So you couldn't escape Social Security, but you couldn't be placed in FERS unless you elected to be in FERS. The folks who were in FERS proper and had no choice are the ones who were basically hired on or after January 1st, 1984, or folks who might have been in the federal service earlier and returned after more than a one-year service break but didn't have that 5 years. So they had no choice. So the problem that you have is when people come back to work for the government, having had some sort of prior service, it's often perceived that they perhaps didn't work for the government in the first place. I mean, you've got an onboarding group in a federal agency and you have a retirement group. Sometimes they're a bit siloed and information isn't compared. And if, depending upon the length of time the person's been gone, it may, you know, not be clear to the people coming that are processing them in that they had prior federal service. So it could be that that's just skipped over, or there's an assumption made that there wasn't any prior federal service. Or in some instances, you have situations where people get left in the wrong retirement plan thinking that they had the creditable service necessary to be in the old plan. There's just a whole variety of errors that came out of this. And it was largely precipitated by the fact that we had a singular system for so many years, and then we have this mishmash of different things during this transitional period, particularly during the mid-80s. Now, when you have a retirement coverage error, it means that, for example, here you are, you've been placed in FERS, but your first federal appointment was prior to 1984, and maybe you were hired on December 31st. But somebody takes a look at you and they see that, well, wait a minute, you don't have 5 years of service before FERS, so you need to be in FERS, as opposed to, well, your first permanent federal appointment in CSRS was before 1984. That person should be CSRS. Now, perhaps the most common situation that I've seen is people who are placed in FERS and should have been CSRS offset. And these are the people who had that prior service of 5 or more years and took a long service break, long meaning more than a year, came back to work after 1983, and they were placed in FERS without the opportunity to elect it. Their correct coverage should have been CSRS offset. Now, many of these types of errors, and believe me, there are like 12 different types of errors, many of them were corrected quickly as agencies found them. But tons of them languished. I say tons, I mean thousands. And when I say languished, existed for more than 3 years. So to deal with these unique, severe situations, a law was passed during the Clinton administration called the Federal Erroneous Retirement Coverage Corrections Act, also known as FERCA. And FERCA basically says that if you're in the wrong retirement plan and you've been in that plan for the wrong plan for more than 3 years before your agency has done something to correct it, then there's some unique things that we're going to afford to you because of the severity of your situation. Number one, you have to see what staying in this plan by error will be. And also, you should be in another plan, usually CSRS offset, FERS, CSRS offset, back and forth, something like that. What do these two plans look like? To use a term that you're familiar with, what is the net present value of each particular plan? I mean, if I switch to CSRS offset, I'm going to get a larger annuity than FERS will give me, even with the Social Security offset that occurs down the road. But then again, my TSP is going to be stripped of the government side of my account, together with all of its matching funds and all of the interest. The Social Security that I get in this situation will be exactly the same. But, you know, what about the annuity versus the TSP? And how can somebody help me navigate that? So FERCA affords individuals, I guess what I would call gold-plated counseling. You get an opportunity to see what both sides look like, a six-month election window, as well as a certain amount of out-of-pocket expenses associated with getting the right advice from experts to navigate and make the best financial decision for your own situation.
Could I ask you a couple simplistic questions?
Sure.
I'm listening to this, and I'm a Fed. What do I ask myself in general? What would be a general profile that would say, boy, after all that, it sounds great, but what's my basic idea that I may qualify for this? Is it somebody that came back soon after that magic date, or somebody that left before that magic date and came back? I mean, is it somebody that came back into the federal service in general after leaving before?
I think the folks who probably are more prone to error are the people who started in the federal government, had a number of years of service, and left thinking they weren't going to come back, and then ultimately did. You may want to double-check your retirement coverage in those situations. Anyone who's been hired since 1987, and certainly actually since 1984, when I say hired, I mean in a permanent job for, with the federal government, is likely FERS and should be. But the folks with what is the term of art that's used have a frozen component of civil CSRS time, meaning that they have five or perhaps more years of creditable or even potentially creditable service under CSRS. They are likely to be placed in the wrong system, and if that's where the I'm not saying likely to be placed, but that's where most of the errors typically happen.
All right, so you mentioned this term net present value. Is that kind of like the Seinfeld do-over?
Well, you'd know more about that than me.
What, Seinfeld?
No, about net present value.
Okay. Well, net present value, without putting anybody to sleep, is to say, okay, if I work backwards, I'd need X dollars to get to where I would have been if I had been traveling in the right path. So somebody's got to figure that out, and then I'm entitled to X dollars, which through one of these shows, it was a number of years ago, somebody's listening from way far away from D.C., way far away, and darn if they didn't qualify. And we can't mention numbers or certainly names. We'd never do that. So for those listening, maybe you're affected, but maybe you know somebody who, maybe you're not affected, but maybe you know somebody who is. And that's why I was asking Bob the general, you know, how do I know?
Yeah, and it's also important to understand what the remedies are. I mean, think about it. One could find out that all of a sudden that, gee, if I'm CSRS offset, or I should be CSRS offset, and I've been FERS, and maybe I haven't been putting that much money into to TSP, but whatever. All of a sudden, I'm looking at an annuity that's close to twice as much as I would have received had I stayed FERS. On the other hand, if I'm CSRS or CSRS offset by mistake, then I've been limited, and for many years, those folks were limited to a 5% contribution to TSP, and now they can contribute what everybody else can. But when you think about all of the lost earnings associated with agency matching, I mean, the 5% match, as well as the interest that would have accumulated on that additional money, it was not uncommon to see TSP accounts with people doing makeup contributions that they were allowed to make, mushrooming by five and six times the value that they had, you know, when the employee found out they were in the wrong plan, you know, from $250,000 to over $1 million just by making $35,000 to $40,000 of makeup contributions.
So this is kind of like if I had done this, I get the best that possibly could have happened, even if it didn't happen.
Correct.
So in order to get this quote net present value, there's an assumption made that the earning power is X, whether it was or wasn't. Now, roughly, how do they figure that? It's not. I'd imagine it's not based on the G fund, but it could be.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're talking about TSP makeup contribution, there's a formula, and it's always been my understanding. There's sort of a break point in the year 2000, but generally speaking, it's either the G fund or a combination of all of the funds, whichever produces the better result. So people doing retroactive these makeup contributions gain the advantage of never having had a crash. I mean, they basically have guaranteed results, always positive, not to mention, you know, the compounding of year after year. So let's say you had a FERCA error that goes all the way back to day one, 87, and you were CSRS by mistake, you know, which happens sometimes. I mean, a typical case like that might be someone who'd had many temporary appointments, FICA-only Social Security appointments, prior to 1983 and didn't have their first permanent appointment, CSRS, which was then CSRS interim, actually, until after 1983. They were left in CSRS because it seemed, you know, the person said, well, I got 5 years of service, they're CSRS now, and just overlooked, left in CSRS by mistake when it should have been CSRS offset or first.
So in fact, somebody sitting there, I was thinking while you were talking, well, gee, if I'm better off, I'm just not going to say anything. But this is a risk-free, gee, here I am.
Right.
I don't know that it would work in the reverse, that if somebody was in that position that they would lose.
Not usually. I mean, what's nice is that you do get a choice. And generally speaking, you wind up being able to pick the better of the two. But again, going back to what I was saying before I got a little sidetracked in my own mind, if I had a FERCA error, which allowed me to do TSP makeup contributions all the way back to 1987. And here it is. What's the year now? 2014? I mean, think of what I lost in matching money, that 5%, and what the accrual rate would be on that. That's guaranteed not to be a loss. I mean, you missed the dot bomb. You missed the 2008 crash. It's not, again, it's not going to, you can't go back and pick and choose what your funds were, but you still are guaranteed positive return.
Wow. I bet there's some people out there that might say, what? 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Today is June 23rd, 2014, Eastern Time, 10:21. We'll be on for about another 37 minutes. What I'm saying is don't call us after that. Not that we wouldn't talk to you, but we can't talk to you. But you can email us, and you can email us at your benefit, BENEFIT, at Federal News, excuse me, at NITPINC.com. For your benefit at NITPINC.com. All righty, Bob, keep going. This is, I'm captivated by it. Each time you come on, what is this, maybe the third time we've done this, fourth
probably,
time?
Probably. Yeah. And, you know, there's some very unique cases out there. And I'm, I think going forward, we're going to put together a panel and talk about some of those things. I remember you talking to me about that. One of the things I'm always interested in is, you know, the types of questions people ask, not even knowing that much about FERCA. But it's not just for retirees. It's not just for employees. It could be for separated employees. One question that I found rather interesting is that FERCA does pertain to a separated employee, even if they don't retire. If you no longer work for the federal government and you're separated, as long as you had a retirement coverage error, if you believe that there was an error, I mean, after all, you're vested, and vested meaning that you could get some kind of a pension down the road with 5 years of creditable civilian service. If you leave federal government before you meet the age and service criteria, you don't really get anything. You're resigning. But, you know, at 62, you could make an application to the Office of Personnel Management for what's known as a deferred retirement annuity. We've talked about these on prior shows. So let's say you're looking at your record and you were FERS, but you find out, well, wait a minute, I should have been CSRS offset or CSRS possibly, rarely, but possibly. If that's the case and you're never even going to come back to work for the government. What you want to be certain of is that when you make application for this deferred retirement annuity, that you're in the right plan. Because a CSRS, even a CSRS offset deferred annuity for 5 or 6 years is going to be much, much larger than FERS. So what's nice is that it doesn't even matter whether you're not working for the government anymore. If you perceive or believe that you have a coverage error, you want to get that locked in so that if and when you do make application many years from now for that deferred benefit, it's going to be in the right retirement coverage.
What if I retired and I qualified for this? I didn't know, and I retired and my annuity started. Taking the annuity check, would that put up the stop sign?
Not necessarily. I mean, if you retired and you find out afterwards that you're in the wrong plan, and then it's basically OPM would be responsible for taking you through the process and changing your coverage. I mean, there are even people who are on the precipice of retiring and they're being told they're in the wrong plan. And the question is, if they're in their election window, what do they do? And essentially, Office of Personnel Management advises, go ahead and make application for the plan that you're in. And we will take it from there based on your current coverage. We're going to take a look at, actually, OPM will be alerted when you retire from your agency. Your agency will alert OPM that there's a FERCA error, and OPM will probably take some additional time adjudicating your case, obviously. But they will ultimately get you the right retirement coverage. You'll have the same six-month window of election and so on. You know, part of the problem associated with that is, you know, the adjudication window of OPM is typically 90 days, maybe a little bit longer. They're paying you lighter checks for the first series of months. A FERCA situation can complicate that and take it beyond the 90 days, obviously. If you're going to spend 6 months electing your coverage, then obviously the Office of Personnel Management is not going to be paying you a full retirement check for a longer period of time.
Okay, let's just take a little tangent on that. Is there an average percentage that the annuity would drop for anybody? Forget any FERCA. So when somebody first retires, like you say, the annuity check is not what it is supposed to be until somebody calculates what it's supposed to be.
It's about 75 to 80% of what it should be.
Okay, what I'm getting at, and you know, it's easy for me to say, but if I was in that position, I don't think I would. That would stop me. Okay, so I deal with 25% or so less. I guess it could be more, but probably, again, more the norm. I'll wait.
Sure. Now, I would think that the amount, the temporary amount being paid to you, if you were considering a FERS scenario, if you were CSRS or CSRS offset by mistake, that would compel an even smaller payment. I mean, in the off chance, or in the chance that you'd be electing FERS to gain the benefit of, say, the enhanced TSP, I mean, clearly, if you're in CSRS by mistake or CSRS offset by mistake, you're not going to be getting 70% of what a CSRS or CSRS offset pension would be, because that'd be a huge overpayment on OPM's part. It'd be hard to recover, and they would probably be paying you some percentage of what a perceived FERS benefit would be. So all of these are things that you need to be thinking about. Not that it would stop you, because in the long run, you'll be made whole. It's just a question of how long you can last and fund the deficit.
Well, the deficit could be funded by monthly distributions from the TSP, and there's two types. One is very flexible. One is mechanical and or an IRA. Probably would go to the IRA first and the TSP second, but not necessarily. It depends on where. How much? Anyway, I'm getting into tax, and we're not going to talk about tax, so I'll be quiet.
Sure. But that's all right. Another question that I get from a lot of folks, too, is, you know, what if I have a coverage error? Do I have to pay anything? And I always tell people that there's a lot of things that will be happening behind the scenes. I mean, this is not your fault. This happened because there was an error that was made on part of the agency, maybe not even the agency that you're in right now. So if you elect to change coverage, I mean, maybe you're going from CSRS to CSRS offset or to FERS, there'll be some adjustment of monies that have been paid in to what's known as the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund. Some of that's going to be funneled back to Social Security or vice versa, and that's all going to be seamless to you. The only cost you could conceivably have is if you elect a FERS coverage and decide to make what we've just been talking about, makeup contributions. The makeup contributions are the amounts you could have been contributing above and beyond what you were allowed to contribute when you were erroneously assigned CSRS coverage or CSRS offset coverage, had you been a FERS employee. They've allowed to do that, and that's what compounds the additional interest and mushrooms that account. But that would be the only cost, and that's your choice. It's up to you to do that.
I remember one that you and I talked about. You worked on it, and they had to put up X dollars. And it was not a small number, mm-hmm. but the reward was, I think it was easily 10 times the X dollars.
Yeah, as I recall, I think this person had roughly $150K and wound up with, I think for putting in roughly $35,000, $850,000. Yeah. And again, that all goes back to the fact that you can't make a mistake. You're not getting the ability to pick and choose your allocation, but you're guaranteed to miss those miserable moments.
Yeah, and I remember talking, they didn't have the cash to do it, which a lot of people don't, and so we talked with the financial planner, and I believe they took a second trust out on the house to get the money.
Right, and the other important thing about makeup contributions, as any direct contribution to TSP, is they have to come out of your paycheck. So, you know, you can get money to live on from somewhere else, and you can also... What is it? You can increase your allowances. And how many allowances can you claim without a note from home?
Well, in theory, it's between 13 and 15 withholding exemptions. For those listening now, the higher the withholding exemption, the lower the tax withholding. So that if you want to really most of your check and you want to kick the can down the road for taxes, you claim a bunch. But remember, come April 15th, you're not going to be a happy camper. But you could do that to increase your cash flow. Actually, just to take a little segue there, sometimes in the retirement planning seminars, we talk about people that leave in June that are and they want to maximize their thrift contribution, but they're only going to be there 6 months. And correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, isn't this called front loading the thrift?
Correct.
And they, you know, if they can afford to do this, they can put in the whole $23,000, depending on age, in the 6 months. But that would seriously hamper take-home pay. But if they cut the withholding, and again, there's no detriment here of an unhappy surprise. It's crazy to have high withholding on money you're not going to pay taxes on just to get a big refund and starve in the interim. Anyway, I'm sorry I took that tangent. But
no, that's all right. No, and you raise a very good point. And it's a point that I make, too, that I learned from you. I think you have to put away for retirement and balance that against your current living needs. I mean, you can't put it all away for tomorrow. Tomorrow's uncertain anyway, but you want to be able to put away enough without making yourself starve, which is really important. I tell new employees coming on board when we teach the earlier classes that get to the government match with your TSB as quickly as possible. My understanding is that they withhold automatically now at 3%, the 3% match level. And there's also something that's going to immediately allocate to the to life cycle funds. But, you know, if you contribute 5% of your income, then you're getting a dollar-for-dollar match on the first 3%, 50 cents on the dollar for the next two, and then you get an automatic 1% contribution from the government, whether you contribute or not. This is the crux of the whole lost earnings issue for folks who, with FERCA errors, wind up electing FERS coverage, you know, retroactive 25, 30 years ago, and boom, all of a sudden they have all of this money with these makeup contributions that, if made, will mushroom their account by a factor of 10. The converse to that is someone who's been in FERS and for, say, the last 25 or 30 years has had that large accumulation on the government side of their account and make the decision that they're going to elect CSRS offset coverage, which is usually the choice. And when that happens, their annuity is going to grow considerably, but they're going to sacrifice a big portion of their TSP account. I mean, it's like the Twilight Zone. When you make that election, it's retroactive to the date of the error. It's as if you've never been in FERS, never were entitled to the government match, so that everything on that side of the account is gone as if it's never been there, vanished.
A tax question just came to my head. If that individual, if you will, had their TSP reduced by the excess that was contributed because they were FERS and they're going to switch to CSRS, I wonder if they'd have to pay tax on that. I don't think so, because if the converse holds true and somebody goes from CSRS to FERS because they've been FERC'd, they don't pay tax on that because it's not taxable until it comes out. But when it does come out, it is taxable.
Yeah.
I'm asking myself the question. And
I'm glad, because I don't know the answer. Now, I'll tell you, when I was working for a small company that was helping the Office of Personnel Management sort of clear its docket of FERCA cases before they ceded that responsibility to federal agencies in 2004. And I think there were about 4,000 cases. I probably handled 1,000 or so on my own. And there were a number of these situations where people were finding out that, well, I don't want to lose that government side to my account. I want to make this election for the larger annuity. And what they were actually able to do, since many of them were 59 and a half or older, they were able to take that age-based withdrawal that TSP allows, pretty much transfer their entire TSP account before they made their election under FERCA to a private IRA. And the money was already out of their account, so there was nothing the government could strip. There was no way to take the funds out. Now, granted, it was no longer in TSP, and the administrative costs of TSP are very inexpensive. If you're in a brokerage, it's four or five times as much, depending upon where you are. But they basically were able to get both bites of the apple. They won the FERCA lottery. I think Ray Kirk.
You just answered my question.
What's that?
If it can be transferred to an IRA and taxes deferred, but somebody elects to take it, you can't defer it, so it's taxable. Thank you, Bob.
That's okay. And again, this is what was happening back in 2004, 2000. Well, actually, when I was working on that project, whether that's been plugged up or not, I'm not sure, because I've heard some description of when it's found that if you've taken the money out already, that there's some sort of an actuarial reduction based on what you took out that's taken off your annuity.
Okay. So what was, could you say, what was the strangest case that you, I mean, you've done an awful lot of these things, or, you know, just one that jumps out and you go, I'm really surprised at how good that was, or I'm really surprised that it wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be.
Well, when you talk about strange cases, the ones that are in the weeds that are sort of one-offs, I'm actually dealing with an individual right now, and I wouldn't so much call it strange, but it's unusual. This individual was a FERCA case, and his retirement coverage was discovered to be in error on the eve of his retirement from federal service. But he went through his election window before he left, and he elected to be in CSRS offset. Now, he retired at the age of 60. And when you retire CSRS offset, until you're eligible for Social Security, your annuity is calculated exactly the same way as a CSRS person. You know, just to cut to the chase, if you had 30 years CSRS time, you get 56.25% of what your high three average salary would be. So this person, let's just say, is getting that. Now, under the offset provisions, OPM has your record flagged, and it should automatically occur that when you turn 62, because this person retired before 62, because you're offset, there'll be a reduction. And the reduction is roughly equivalent, this is a general formula, to taking 40 years, that's what OPM considers a full working career of years, divided into the years that you'd been in the offset program, which is, you know, when you came back, you were started paying Social Security. Let's say you had 20 years offset. 40 into 20 would be 50%. And let's say your Social Security benefit at age 62 was $20,000 a year. That means 50% of $20,000 a year should be that at that point subtracted from your federal annuity. That's what the Social Security offset would be. And then, of course, you can go get your Social Security, which is $20,000, and that more than makes up the difference. What happened in this person's case is that the offset never happened. And in his mind, because things happened so quickly before he retired, because he's still working robustly, he assumed that if he just continued to work and enhance his Social Security benefit to an amount that's not even going to be windfall eliminated, which is something else we could talk about, but have 30 or more years of substantial earnings, that that would eliminate the offset, which, of course, it wouldn't, but it's so confusing at the time. I mean, it takes a career to learn about some of this stuff. So it wasn't until he actually talked to a couple of his buddies who informed him that it doesn't matter how much longer you work, the offset occurs anyway, even if you don't draw your Social Security amount. So in his situation, I've been working with him, it looks like for the last 2.5 years, there's been no offset. And we have figured that it's roughly $35,000 that he essentially owes back to OPM. Now, it's not his fault, so he would need to get some kind of a payment schedule going. But right now, I'm still advising this person. You know, one could essentially own up, or one could cast your fate to the wind and just say, well, I'm going to wait till they catch me and I'll just bank that money and gain interest on it. I mean, it's not his mistake. As a result, there won't be any interest on what he owes. But ultimately, if the Office of Personnel Management touches that case through some kind of a health insurance change or anything like that, they're going to find it. So it's a question of how long do you want it to be there? How disciplined are you to continue to put the money away that you're being overpaid? Or is it better not to just simply come clean and now that it's 2.5 years along the road? I mean, that's a challenging case. That's and again, it was FERCA born, but it has other issues. And, you know, FERCA is so complex, when it happens fast, it's hard, you know, hard for the individual to really know what they're electing, especially when it comes to the offset.
I'm going to make a comment here. For those of you all listening, hopefully you're still listening because this is really good, but it might be good to mention this to somebody in their HR office. We don't sell anything, so there's no commercials. Bob isn't trying to get additional work. The company does retirement seminars, and that's it. But here's something that could be in the proverbial can that somebody could listen to. And if for no other reason, maybe somebody could listen to it that was in a position that oversees this And you've got some really fine points here, driven by Bob's clear voice and clear instructions and knowledge that this would be, we affectionately call this a evergreen show. You could play this any time of the year, and it has application, but I think it would have more application to somebody that is, I don't know if I qualify for this, and Bob has really sliced and diced it. Thank you.
Pleasure.
And, you know, what's this, the fourth one? And I'm still learning.
But, you know, one of the things that we do in the seminars, and I believe it's probably one of the most valuable things that if anyone's worried about their retirement coverage, it's one of the more valuable things we do is we give a brief history of retirement. I mean, CSRS started in 1920, exempt from Social Security. Well, of course it was. There was no Social Security until 1935. But then it remained exempt. And with the change that occurred in 1983, the Social Security Amendment Act, new feds, people with their first permanent appointments coming on board after 1983, had to start paying Social Security. And then FERS was finally launched in 1987. I mean, we discuss the history and what happened and what the requirements were. And when we go through that, we say, now, if based on this discussion of the history and where your placement should be, if you think for some reason you might be in the wrong plan, come up and talk to me at the break. And oddly enough, every other seminar or two, somebody will come up and they think they have an error. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But a lot of the FERCA cases that I've come up with have actually been during seminars. It's driven to a degree of by the history lesson we give them, because they really didn't understand, you know, why they were in FERS. You get a lot of people who think that they were hired before FERS. Well, wait a minute. I came on board in January of 1985. Why am I in FERS? FERS wasn't even a plan yet, because they don't understand that, you know, after 1983, if your first permanent federal appointment, even though there wasn't FERS, was after 1983, then you were automatically converted with no choice at all.
You know what I like, which I learned today, that you could be retired and gain a benefit from this. So, I mean, it
Absolutely.
Isn't just for the people working, it's for the, and again, it's a definition of a class of staff members, if you will, employees. It's just not anybody.
That's right. And retirees, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that one too. One of the options they don't have, I mean, is to do TSP makeup contributions, because they don't work for the government anymore. But somebody who's retired, who's in FERS by mistake, you know, might do well to consider CSRS offset. You know, I don't know what they've done with their TSP account. Obviously, if they still have it or if they've moved it, but they could really increase their annuity. They just wouldn't be able to capitalize on the makeup contributions, which, once again, you've got to stand board as an active federal employee for that to happen.
Okay, there's got to be somebody out there with a question on what we're doing, or you could ask us any question on Social Security, federal benefits, tax, and to a degree, finance. Probably the only thing we can't do is psychology, but I think we could deal with that, because you've been there, done this. I wish I could.
Me too.
We're at 202-465-3080. We really need a phone call, because I don't think we've had a show in a long time where we didn't get a phone call. 202-465-3080. The phone lines are open, and you can ask us most anything you want. Anyway, let's come back to the focus. Actually, there was an email that came in. It wasn't directly on this, but it's a fan of the show, well outside the beltway. The questions are generally right on target. And this one requires a little bit of a crystal ball, but it says, what changes does your guest, Bob, see in federal employee benefits after the elections? Now, we got midterm elections. I don't know. I would think probably it's going to be the other elections after 2 years, if there is any. But you know, you've been around long enough to watch them for. Mm-hmm. I don't. I mean, I see tax changes coming after changes in
sure.
the election, in the presidential elections. I don't see a ton necessarily in the midterms, but they make some pretty significant tax law changes every year. Although last year was really quiet. Anyway.
Well, there have been some changes that have occurred very recently. I mean, without even, you know, the elections. One of the big changes was, I guess, a result of the recent budget that was passed. The president agreed to raise contributions for FERS on a biweekly basis. It's happened actually twice. the people in FERS initially were paying a very small amount biweekly into the Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund. It's being deducted from their pay, 0.8 of 1%. That changed in 2012. Actually, the folks coming on board in 2013, January 1, 2013 or later, started paying 3.2%. And it changed again for the folks coming on board January 1st, 2014 to, I believe, 4.4 or 4.5. Memory doesn't serve. The folks in 2013 are now called FERS Revised Annuity Employees, FERS RAE. And now we have the people in 2014 who are FERS FRAE, Further Revised Employees. It's interesting. You and I talked about this. As time goes by, when these folks decide to leave federal service for a period of time and then come back, it's going to be interesting to see whether the FERS people are put in FERS or FERS FRAE or FERS RAE, and whether this is going to be another FERCA tsunami. One can never know. But some of the other changes that have always been on the table that are being discussed and may or may not happen is possibly migrating to a high 5 average salary from a high 3. Now, there's nothing to suggest that that's going to happen. I mean, that was being batted back and forth the entire time I was with the Federal Service, which was back in the Stone Age, right? You know, from 1967 to 1997. And when I came on board, I think things had just migrated to a high 3. But there's been a move afoot to try to make it a high 5. Other benefits, I don't see huge changes coming along. Health benefits are pretty much the same. The Affordable Care Act really hasn't changed that for federal employees. Dental and vision coverage remains the same. Now, flexible spending accounts for health care, of course, were reduced fairly recently from $5,000 to $2,500. But I don't see huge changes on the horizon. There may be some contribution adjustments and for some of the defined benefits as time goes by, and possibly a high 5.
Okay, now for those of y'all, so what's a defined benefit? That's your retirement. Let's take a little detour here, because you and I were talking annuity. When I do this in class, they go, no, we have a pension. And I actually have the OPM form, and I said, look at the form. It says annuity. What's the difference between an annuity and a pension? And I said, well, an annuity is a promise by somebody or some company or something to pay you a monthly amount for life, annual payment. And in this case, what we're talking about is the federal government's promise to pay you, and it really has nothing to do with what was withheld from you. It has everything to do with years in service and highest compensation. Now, I'm skipping through an extremely large minefield, but that's basically what it is, and it's promised to be paid for you, to you. Now, the thrift has an annuity portion. And if somebody says, I would like at a certain age or a certain time in life, I want to buy the thrift annuity. Now, they're not buying it from the thrift board. They're buying it from Metropolitan Life, who's had it since inception. But it has to be a large, solid company, because these things got to be sold throughout the United States. But here's the difference. The annuity there has got nothing to do with your years in service and has got nothing to do with your high 3. It has everything to do with how old you are and how much you're going to invest. But it also has a direct correlation to interest rates in the environment. Not saying that it's bad. Also has a direct correlation. Somebody older buying an annuity with, I'm going to use just an easy number, $10,000, is going to get a greater monthly benefit than somebody younger. Why? Because it's a monthly payment for life. There's less time to pay it, and the person buying it is going to want a premium because of the age. Now, when you're talking about the thrift, you're talking about more than $10,000. And somebody says, well, what difference is that than a pension? Now, remember what a pension is. It's a promise by a chunk of money to pay you something. So if a company puts money into a pension plan, then the pension is paid as long as the money is there. And I say this in class. Can you say Enron? All righty. Now, Enron had a pension plan, and it was actually chock full of Enron stock. Ask those folks how much they're getting. But if that same money had been put into a company that sells annuities, then Generally, insurance companies sell annuities. Well, it's a ripoff. But again, that's the difference. I'm not saying it is a ripoff, but as soon as you say that, and by the way, I don't know too many people who read Barron's, but it's a weekly publication, and they have the best rated annuities. I think it's the 50 best, and it's actually good reading, and it defines the different type of annuities that you can get.
Let me ask you a question about that. One of the statistics that we hear about, and I think a light bulb just came on for me based on what you're talking about. People who are retiring, there aren't too many of them electing these MetLife annuities. It's a very small percentage of folks, like 5%, I think I've been told. And is it possible that, you know, it is fixed rate, it's not variable, and I couldn't even begin to talk to you about what that means, but locking one of those things in when you're younger, based on what you just said, means life expectancy is longer and you're locking in a lower payment. But if, say, down the road, you decided to get that annuity, maybe, you know, when you're in your 70s or when you reach required minimum distribution and you're mm-hmm. making that allotment, when you're 70, obviously, you're not going to be on the planet as long, actuarially. And it might make sense because you're going to get a much larger payment given the, again, the more abbreviated time that you're going to be alive.
Right.
Wow. And I never even stopped to think about it that way.
Yeah. And people say, well, how do they come up with the number? Now, remember, it's got to be somewhat interest rate based, but it can't be in today's low rates of interest. It's got to be better than that. Otherwise, you wouldn't buy it.
Right.
But if people, and I do this in class, I said, we're going to switch sides. I'm you, you're MetLife. And I said, over there, you're the marketing people. You ask me how old I am. I tell you how much I'm going to invest. And then they say, hold the line. They call the actuarial folks up. And they say, it looks like a male. He looks like he's 66. What are they doing? They're trying to figure out how long I'm going to live statistically, who then call the investment folks and say, got one. Male, 66. Normal life expectancy is X. You better make more than what you're paying him. And then the final marketing people put it together. I mean, that's really what it is. It wouldn't be any different than anybody listening or anybody sitting in the studio. If you give them a chunk of money and you have to pay them for life, then you better know how old they are. And in the case of the thrift annuity, you can't ask about health. And then you got to figure out how you're going to make at least as much, and you better make more than what you're paying the individual because you're on the hook. And I tell the same tired war story, and it's true. And it happened 13 years ago, and I'm going to embarrass myself, but this will drive the point home. Individual retires, had money in the thrift, very good money manager. I said, what are you going to do with it? Put it in an IRA like everything else and play with it? And the response was, no, I'm going to buy the MetLife annuity. Now, remember, this person was very good managing their money. And me not being that good at that time. I said, why would you do that? It only pays 7.3% interest. Now, we talk probably three times a year, and I'm reminded of that comment at the beginning of every telephone conversation because he was brilliant. And yeah. Now, the good news is he's still alive.
And he's still getting 7.
Yep.
Wow. Now, what are the interest rates now?
Probably, let's say 3-ish. I mean, the interest rates in today's environment aren't that, but they got to pay you more. But remember, if I use a percentage, it's not necessarily the same percentage for everybody because the closer you get to the end line, the higher the monthly payment.
So the key is to find the time to lock one of these things in when interest rates are up. Or to be fortunate enough for that to happen.
Bingo. It's kind of like years ago when interest rates were high. I'm not going to go back to the 18%. But when interest rates were high, people were buying long-term government bonds, and they were able to clearly see the future and saw that interest rates were going to go down, and they earned in this decent rate of return. And, in fact, the value of their bond went up, even though it was a government bond. So it's kind of like, do I buy something on sale or do I wait for it to go up? I don't know. I think buy it on sale.
It kills me that I become more and more financially savvy as I get older and older. I should have learned this stuff years and years ago.
No. we all do what we do. You learn, and I think what you know is harder than what I know. You learn the benefits, and to me, that's just a quagmire, but you know it. And, you know, I live in the tax world, and that's a quagmire, and I know I don't know it. I know a certain segment of it, but I don't know corporate reorganizations, and unfortunately, I know foreign bank accounts more than I wish I ever knew, but, you know, the average tax return, do this or do that, but people don't understand their tax bracket. That's what I pound on in class. You know, taxes are high. Yeah, but your next dollar in really gets creamed, or
right.
The next dollar saved really gets saved tax-wise. Anyway, I'm taking away from your spotlight.
No, not at all. It's really important to know all of these things. I mean, financial literacy from womb to tomb. I mean, all the seminars that we're doing now for the agencies that allow us in, for the younger folks, I'm having some of my most appreciative groups in with the younger groups right now.
Do you find more younger people in your classes pre-retirement than, I'm not talking 20-year-olds, but they might be in their 30s or 40s?
It, you know, and again, it depends upon agency policy. Some are still limiting the seminars to folks who are within 5 years of retiring, but others are not. And I've had some, you know, in classes where people who are on the precipice, on the edge of retiring, there have been people, brand new employees in there, who've been there, not even vested in their retirement plan.
Bob and I are driving some points home. They might be subtle, but I do the same thing. But I go up to them in class. I mean, it's none of my business. And I tell them, listen, this is none of my business, but, you know, you clearly are younger than the rest of the people in here. And they go, yeah, because I want to learn now. I don't want to be sitting in the class 15 years from now wishing, gee, I wish I had heard this 15 years earlier. Some of it has no application to them, but most of it does. It's the principle, like you say, of financial planning and the like,
right.
And then knowing the benefits. And they're the astute ones. I had one in, I don't think they were 30.
Yeah, I always congratulate these folks.
Yeah.
Well, they learn what they should and shouldn't do if they ever left federal service,
yeah.
And investing and so on and so forth.
All righty, Bob, we got a minute left. Final comments?
Well, again, you know, you might be a FERCA case. Let me close with saying you should be civil service retirement system if you were hired in a CSRS-covered job prior to January 1st, 1984. You're generally going to be FERS if you were hired after 1983 and didn't have at least 5 years of creditable civilian service that could have been CSRS. You might be CSRS offset if something else has occurred. Again, consider where you are when you came on board. And if you think you have a retirement coverage error, then bring that to your agency's attention as soon as possible.
Okay, quickly, how does somebody get in touch with you real fast?
In touch with me?
Yeah.
Well, through NITP.
Okay, great.
And that's... You have an info line. I mean, I have private information, but if they want to get in touch with me, should I give them my email address?
We're going to get cut off anyway, or are we going to be cut off? Do it anyway. They can shorten it.
If they want to email me, it's bob@rjbronstein.com.
Okay. And this is bob@nitpinc.com.
That's
and we'll be back next week with Mark Levine, an attorney, and we'll be talking about something to do with legal planning prior to. Thank you, and have a good week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
This is John Gilroy from FedTech Talk. Wanted to tell you about a local company that has had a national impact on airline safety. For the past 3 decades, Electromech has worked with federal agencies to make sure aircraft wiring is safe and reliable. Electromech is responsible for testing, inspecting, and analyzing a wide range of electrical wire interconnect systems. For a white paper on addressing fleet management needs, please visit electromech.com. That's electromec.com.
You can go to the Windows store and you can buy Windows, but it's not an ISO. It's actually an executable that just installs on your machine. Is that the Windows 8 ISO that you have downloaded is probably an illegal copy. You say, well, why would people do that? Because what they do is they take legitimate Windows, they add malware to them, they get people to download them. When you install them on your machine, you got malware baked into your machine.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.